Welcome to the Ackerman Center podcast.
As a digital extension of the Ackerman Center, our goal is to teach the past so we can change the future.
In doing so, we address issues related to Holocaust, genocide, and human rights studies from diverse perspectives.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're excited to welcome a very, very, very special person today, Dr. Hanno Berger. Hanno joined us as an assistant professor in film studies and the fellow of the Miriam Lewis Burnett Chair for Studies Related to Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights. So this is in many ways a wonderful new addition to our faculty, and we're thrilled really to have you now on campus already for quite a while. And you've been walking and talking and teaching and writing and doing all the kinds of things faculty does. So welcome to campus and welcome to the Ackerman Center, and thank you for being here with us. Tell us a little bit about where you came from.
First of all, thank you very much for this very nice introduction. So I'm from Germany. I was born and grew up in Frankfurt. But when I started college, I moved to Berlin, and then I did my BA and my MA in film studies in Berlin, and also my PhD in film studies I did at the Free University in Berlin.
So studying in Berlin is on the one side, I guess, an encounter with the history of film, you know, whole history of filmmaking tied with Berlin in the 1920s and the vendors and whatever else one can kind of throw in. But it's also like an encounter with history almost at every part that one turns on in Berlin. Was that part of how you studied in Berlin as well, that you were in aesthetic studies and kind of thinking from it from the perspective of history and its legacies as well? Or,
well, in a way, yes, but I never did consciously, or I never reflected that much on it. But it was definitely the case that depending on which quarter you were walking through, you could tell whether you were in the former GDR or in former West Germany, and the cities, the streets themselves had a very different look to it, a very different aesthetic. And I thought that was very, very intriguing. And that what was one of the reasons what made Berlin so interesting.
Well, I believe to this day, you can see always easily whether you're in former East or former West if you just look at the streetlights, right?
Yes.
For the green looks different in the East than it does in the West.
Yeah.
So in that respect, you always know. But even today, you're right. There's a very clear sense as you're walking around that there are discernible differences between the West and the East. And it extends also to street names, where there's a bit more of the kind of former Eastern part and some street names alive than, you know, that would have been in the West. So tell us about your studies, film in Berlin. You know, did you study a lot of the German classics of the 1920s and the Fritz Lange and all of that? Or was it all post-war?
Of course, there's like no way around of also not just Fritz Lang, but also, for example, Dr. Caligari, which is like
scary stuff.
Yes.
We just had Halloween. We don't want to go
there. But very important and very interesting. But really studying and working on during my time in Berlin I was working mostly on post-war German films, and especially for like 2 years, I was in a research project on West German genre cinema of the 1950s and 1960s, which are movies that are probably not that well known in the US, but in Germany, almost everyone knows them, especially since these are the movies that, at one point I realized that the TV channels show these films whenever there's some sort of holiday or like a free day. Like these are like German Westerns, like the Karl May movies.
Yeah. Oh, Karl May. Karl May.
And also like crime stories, the Edgar Wallace movies,
yes.
But also a lot of what is called Heimatfilme, about the
like, kind of home and belonging, but there's a lot of landscape and mountains and things like that in there.
It's and the like countryside.
The countryside.
But also some musicals, like Im Weißen Rössel am Wolfgangsee, for example.
This is one where you really are on the edge of your seat and you want to dance along. I remember that as well. But here things get now messy. So I think I like, you know, this interest in movies of the 50s and 60s, because I think a lot of pop culture, popular culture at that time, was really creating escape fantasies of sorts to a nation that otherwise was really far from having dealt effectively with its most recent past, the Third Reich. So you have that whole run of these popular songs about Greece and Spain, and there you have films about the mountains and nature. And so they kind of make sense. But the things that, you know, we thought was really interesting about you, that while you were pursuing these studies in film, you also then kind of thought about them from a perspective that is a little different from thinking just aesthetically about them, because your dissertation had the title, I translate this into Film Thinks Revolution, an Audiovisual Staging of Political Change. So that's a little bit different than just thinking about some mountains and some cows and some singing and dancing of, you know, that we otherwise associate with some of the movies. So there's a very clear kind of political interest, or thinking about political thought on the one side and film on the other, that overtly seems to suggest, Hanno, you didn't know what you were doing. You were like dabbling or running in two different lanes, political studies and film studies. Is there something to this?
Well, I hope I at least knew a little bit what I was doing, but that is definitely the case, that especially when it came to my PhD thesis, I in a way focused on two fields, on the fields of film studies and on the fields of political theory. So in my PhD thesis, I looked at films that depict revolutions. And the question behind that PhD thesis is, how can films help us understand and theorize revolutions? And one very important point of reference for me for that PhD thesis was Hannah Arendt's book On Revolution.
So we'll come to your other interest in Arendt in a moment, but I want to like go back to this. There's a lot to unpack, because what you're suggesting is that film about revolutions is actually not just simply retelling the tale about the French Revolution or the 1848 or whichever one, but it's actually a way to think and understand revolution, which is very different from just simply, you know, the way we're looking sometimes at historical movies is we don't expect there to be a surplus of knowledge, but rather a more popularized retelling of pre-existing knowledge. But that's, I think, how you don't think about films.
Exactly. So what I wanted to avoid was to simply compare the films with the quote-unquote actual historical event and to say, okay, here the film is wrong because actually what happened was this and that. What I was trying to do is to, as you mentioned, see the medium film as a way of thinking and to see the films on revolutions as a way of conceptualizing these revolutions that they depict and thereby enable us to enlarge our notion of revolution and how revolutions look like and how we can understand revolutions.
So let's step away from revolutions for a moment, but would it be fair to say that that's how, more generally speaking, you think about films these days, that you think about films as a way of articulating and kind of visualizing a certain way of comprehension or knowledge, and not just simply as a popularization of something that already exists elsewhere?
Yes, definitely. A way of understanding and conceptualization, a way of thinking that is different than thinking in language.
Okay.
It's a sort of thinking in images.
So that's really important, and I think really something that resonated with us very strongly. We in the school, we have all our different disciplines and our different core homes in the way in which we interpret, teach, and write, and sing, and dance, whatever we do. But you're kind of thinking about this more clearly in terms of thinking that each one of these media or these art forms has also their particular way of cognition and of telling, so to speak.
Yes. Definitely.
Very, very interesting. That's why it's been so much fun to teach with him together, because one of my great lucky strikes this semester is that I've been fortunate to teach along with you a class on Holocaust and genocides that has actually quite a bit built into it about representations, film, photos, and other things. And that has been wonderful for me to do this alongside you, because you come at it in a very different way than I do. And so hopefully it has been entertaining to our students as well. But now let's get to, you already hinted at it, you already said Hannah Arendt. So one of the other kind of steps on your itinerary from Frankfurt to Berlin to Dallas was one stop in between, and that involved, well, Vanderbilt and other locations, but your work on Hannah Arendt. Do you mind speaking a little bit about that?
So after I finished my PhD thesis, I kind of, in a way, switched fields and started working in the field of philology and political theory. I started at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, in a research group that is publishing a critical edition of Hannah Arendt's work. And currently, I'm one of the co-editors of Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, or as the German version is called, Elemente und Ursprünge totaler Herrschaft. And maybe I can elaborate a little bit on what a critical edition is, because sometimes I think that critical edition is something rather German, and I'm not sure how well known this concept of a critical edition is in the US. So what we are doing in this project is creating a scholarly edition of Hannah Arendt's work. This means we don't make any changes to her texts. And this also means that we are publishing the drafts of her text that can be found in the archive so that the reader can see the developments of her thoughts. But we also annotate her text. That means we check her sources, and sometimes she only alludes to a certain source and doesn't really reveal her source, and then we try to point out what she is actually referring to. And if she quotes a sentence, then we also give some more context to that sentence. And yeah, sometimes her footnotes also are just faulty. So sometimes there are mistakes. We check that too. And then in our annotations, if there's a mistake, we say, okay, actually this quote can be found.
How about just in terms of visualizing this, first of all, if memory serves, the origin of totalitarianism was to begin with not a slim volume. It's quite, substantial to begin with. Now, with all the annotation and the various versions, what are we looking at, 1,000 pages?
Going to be more like 4 times 1,000 pages. Yeah. So, at a certain amount of pages, the publisher says, well, we cannot bind the book anymore. So there is a certain limit to that. But the book has 3 parts. Part 1 is called Anti-Semitism, Part 2, Imperialism, and Part 3, Totalitarianism. And the plan is to publish one physical book, that is the Anti-Semitism part, then a second physical book, that is the Imperialism part, and a third one, that is the Totalitarianism part, and then a fourth one that has all the works that she did in preparation for this book, the text she published before she published the book, but that would end up becoming a part of the book, and some of our commentaries.
And when this hits the bookstores, it comes with a backpack so that you can take it home, or how does that work?
That would be nice. No, it will come with a, I don't know the English term, like a shuba. So
a shoebox or something like that.
Something like that.
Maybe just to tease this out a little bit, you already gave us a bit of a sense of the content of the book, but Hannah Arendt thinks about anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, and totalitarianism and colonialism in very particular ways that seem these days to attract quite a bit of attention again. Can you speak a little bit to why this text attracts this deal of attention? 4,000 pages. There's an assumption that every shred of paper about this is somehow meaningful. Why is that the case?
Well, I would say there are several reasons. One of them being, of course, that the idea or the concept of totalitarianism, people are getting more and more interested in that again, and it seems to become more and more relevant again. And the other reason is that, or one of the other reasons, she, 3 parts, and these parts are also the subtitle of the book, and she has the term imperialism as one of the subtitles and the term totalitarianism. So maybe her book gives us the opportunity to see a connection between these two things. that there is some sort of connection.
I mean, historically, and in the ways in which, you know, imperialism, you know, expressed itself in its colonial forms, and then it kind of lines up. But I think there's really a lot to relearn or to revisit with Arendt, and she remains really ever so current, almost uncannily so at this point. And so I think it's only befitting that therefore there's finally this critical edition, 4,000 pages, starting to come out. And I think the first volume or so is expected to come out this year? Or?
No, we already published three volumes. Okay. And the fourth one is coming soon. And our book, the plan is to publish it in fall 2024.
So, I mean, the kind of practical mind of mine would suggest, is that maybe an idea to publish it also somewhere online, that you don't have to drag those four volumes always behind you?
Yes, very okay. much so. And maybe I should make a short correction first. So the four books of the origins of totalitarianism, they will all come out in the fall of 24. When I said that there is a book that is already published, I was referring to books within the critical edition of Hannah Arendt,
yes,
but not
yes,
the
not
part of
no,
the
okay.
origins of
that was
the, maybe
sense as well. Okay,
I
no, very good.
Clarified it. Yes, no, we also have an online version where 1 year after we publish the book version, we will publish an online version, and the website will be launched 1 week from now. And this will enable a whole different world of opportunities. Maybe I can phrase it like that. So it will be like much more interactive in a way. So you can scroll over the TypeScript and see like the things she crossed out, what are underneath her, the things that she crossed out, or when she typed something over, what you can see underneath that. And it will also give you the possibility to compare certain texts, since like the digital humanities offer us a lot of tools that we can work with, and where we can see or read text differently than we can do it.
Well, it's, you know, it seems to allow us more to kind of encounter a book in its process of becoming, because you can kind of see the evolution, but then also, you know, enables us to kind of revisit the intellectual orbit, you know, that allowed Hannah Arendt to create this, because everything is referenced and cited. So really, really exciting. Let's move to here. So this is Hannah Arendt there. It's the 50s in Berlin. It's the mountains and the cows and whatever else is in weird German movies of the 1950s. How about now that you're on campus? You've just about a few more weeks and you will have finished your first semester. Tell us a little bit about your first classes that you've taught and your impression thus far.
So I taught two classes this semester. The one class you already mentioned is
great class. Where we, he has a great teacher alongside with him.
Exactly. It's enlightening, I would say, teaching that class on, like, the official title is Representations of the Holocaust, Genocide and Human Rights. And we talk about the Holocaust, but also about the Armenian Genocide, about the genocide in Rwanda. We talk about the rape of Nanking. And we not just talk about the historical events, but as you mentioned earlier, also about, in the US you would say representations of these events, or like films about these genocides or the memorial sites. So it's a very, well, the term interesting is kind of used too often, or not always means something, but here I would say it really means it's a very interesting and helpful and enlightening course.
Yeah, you know, I think the students appreciate it because it provides really a broad introduction. It's also therefore quite taxing because every week there's another kind of really challenging case that we're studying. But also in the course of the semester, we all collectively learn a certain kind of set of words and ways of thinking and talking about these subjects. And so I think there's this kind of, right, it moves forward. And so at this point, we're a little smarter than we were last week. And hopefully in another 2 weeks' time, we'll get a bit more advanced. How about your other class?
So my other class is an undergraduate class, and it's titled Transnational Film and Video. And as the title says, it's about transnational films. So we watch films from all over the world and discuss these films. Then we talk about these films and see in what way do they differ from what the students usually watch. So like in what way do they differ from, for example, a Hollywood movie? And does it make sense to compare these movies to Hollywood movies? Or do these movies maybe don't care about Hollywood and just do their own thing? So does it make sense to always use Hollywood as a point of reference? So these are questions that we debate in that class.
All right, let me just maybe conclude a couple other questions. So, you know, whenever one moves and kind of plans one's life elsewhere, you have like certain ideas about how everything will be. Anything that surprised you?
I mean, the first thing that I have to say is, even though I expected it to be hot, I didn't expect it to be that hot when I arrived in August.
I think none of us
did.
So. I think this summer was exceptionally warm. And we were all laughing here with you because we were all struggling this summer. Yes. So certainly we could see that that was surprising.
So, but what I kind of didn't expect and what surprised me in a positive way is how diverse the campus is and how diverse the city is and also how vibrant everything is. I would say both the city, Dallas, and the campus. So there's a lot going on. There are a lot of events and everything seems very, very lively. And I like that a lot.
Very good. In terms of like thinking ahead, I mean, you're part of the Ackerman Center. What ideally are things that you want to focus on going forward? Obviously more classes. Do you want to do study abroad programs? Do you want to, you know, have your own film series? Or do you want, what is it that you think ideally in the future would you like to be able to accomplish here?
Well, that's the good thing that there are so many opportunities. And yes, study abroad in Berlin, I can imagine that.
Oh,
and
I go
to like visit the memorial sites there or visit the movie theaters there or the location sites there. Like that would be an opportunity. But when you mentioned film series, I mean, of course, I was thinking a lot about like Arendt and film and how one might connect these two areas. And one idea would be to teach a class on that, but another idea might also to do a film series on films that aren't talked about, for example.
Very interesting. All right, I think if you haven't done so already by now, you definitely want to make sure if you listen to this that you're enrolled in your spring classes or come to any of your upcoming lectures or events. We're really thrilled to have you here. Thank you today for this interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
This podcast is hosted by a team of dedicated faculty and research assistants at the Ackerman Center for Holocaust Studies. You can learn more about our work and find upcoming events at our website, www.ackerman.utdallas.edu.